Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and as usual, we are live. This is a program that's live Monday through Friday at this same time, and with an open phone line for you to join us. Actually, the lines are full, so it's not exactly open at the moment, but these lines will be opening up throughout the hour. And if you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, you can call through and we can talk to you here. The number is 844-484-5737. Again, that's 844-484-5737. I want to remind our listeners in Southern California that this Saturday we have a meeting in Buena Park. I'll be giving an introduction and overview of the Gospel of John. We've been going through each month a different book. This is how far we've got. We started in Genesis, now we're in John. Of course, we only have these meetings once a month, so it takes a while to get through the Bible, so it's been years. However, this is a fairly predictable monthly meeting, and you can join us if you're interested in the area. You'll want to go to thenarrowpath.com and look under the tab that says Announcements if you don't already know where these meetings are. You can find out, and we'd be glad to see you. Also, my wife and I will be making a road trip, and I'll be speaking a number of places between California and Indiana, starting at the end of this month. And I'll be speaking in Roseville up in Sacramento area. I'll be speaking in probably Fresno. We don't have it nailed down, but that's at the beginning in California. Then we'll be heading east, and at our Facebook page, Steve Gregg, The Narrow Path, Facebook page, you can see sort of a map of and a list of towns we'll be going through. And the reason we give that is because we still have the opportunity to set up some things, and even, I don't mean necessarily events. We don't need any more events, although I'd be open to it. We do have some days free that I could do that, but mainly just, frankly, listeners, friends of ours, friends of the ministry, wanted to get together. Two or three, four people or whatever, and just have lunch together or something and visit. We like to get to know the people that are friends of the ministry. And you don't have to be anyone special. If you're a friend of the ministry, you're special enough. So you can look at our Facebook page, Steve Gregg, The Narrow Path, and see where we're going. And if you see we're coming through your town and you'd like us to be in touch, we may be able to do that. We'll have to wait and see how many people request this. But you can contact me by going to an email, steve@thenarrowpath.com. And we're setting up kind of an itinerary at the moment. So if you're interested, give us an email shout-out, and we can see if there's any way we can accommodate you. Okay, we're going to go to the phones and talk to John from Bothell, Washington. John, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hello, Steve. Been listening for a long time. I'm 73 years old, and I've been a Christian for 65 years.
Great.
And I love the Lord, been walking with him, and it gets better and better. I was raised in a home that taught that you need to fear the Lord in the sense that if you mess up, you step out of line one time, you're going to miss out on heaven. And God is a very intolerant God. I've largely conquered that, but I'm asking about Matthew 25, verses 31 to 46, and it has me a little concerned. This is where Jesus condemns people who have ignored the hungry, the thirsty, the naked, etc. So I've been concerned that, boy, I haven't done enough. Now, I've done Bible study, and I actually work with missionaries. I can tell you all the things I've done. I've sent money, but I'm feeling that my record is really poor. I'm not going to prisons. I'm just not doing enough in this area so that Christ would welcome me into heaven. I'm working on that. But here are maybe three questions. Are there a lot of Christians who serve the Lord and walk close with him, and maybe they're evangelists, but they're not really feeding the poor, and they're not working in prisons? It kind of sounds like Jesus is saying, you're not welcome into heaven because you haven't done these specific things. And second question would be, how does this passage relate to the idea that salvation is not of works? It seems like Jesus is saying works are necessary, or you're going to be banned to eternal punishment. I think I'll just leave it at those two questions, and I'll take your answer off the air.
Okay. Yeah, I'll be glad to talk about those things, John.
Thank you for your call.
And God bless you.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bless you.
Well, John, I think you were raised in an overly legalistic environment, which probably made you nervous about whether you've done enough avoided enough bad things. And people raised in that kind of a religious environment often feel that God is, you know, going to have these scales out and say, did you do more good deeds than bad deeds? If your bad deeds outweigh the good ones, then sorry, I can't take you to heaven. On the other hand, if you have more good deeds than bad deeds, then, you know, you got a good chance of it. And so you mentioned you were raised thinking that you fear God in such a way as that you feel like if you commit a sin, step out of line in any way, you're going to go to hell. The Bible does not teach that. James, the Lord's brother, wrote the book of James, and he said, in many things we all stumble. And he was including himself in that we. It's obvious that we do stumble. We're not perfect. Stumbling is not a proof that we're not Christians. And we are not going to go to heaven because God's going to weigh how many good deeds we did as opposed to how many bad deeds we did. God does look at our works. In fact, the Bible always says that we'll be judged by our works. You mentioned Matthew 25, the sheep and the goats judgment. Jesus mentions very strictly these people are judged by their works. And so does every other passage about judgment say. Peter himself said in 1 Peter chapter 1, he said, you know, if you call God your Father, who without partiality judges everyone according to his works, pass the time of your sojourning here in fear. However, the fear of God is, it's not what you're thinking. It's not that God is easily peeved, has a short fuse, he's just looking for some reason to strike anyone who steps out of line. It's not that way at all. It's rather that God is actually has a very long fuse in most cases. And he definitely, you know, is slow to wrath and plenteous in mercy. And that's an Old Testament statement. Of course, the New Testament would confirm it. But he's slow to anger and plenteous in mercy. He's not someone who's going to just fly off the handle as soon as you do something wrong. He's not that thin-skinned. He doesn't suffer such a personal injury by your stumbling. That somehow, you know, you've damaged his whole plan and therefore he's got to get back at you and punish you for that. What it is he wants a relationship with us, which it sounds like you have, which is determined to put him first in our lives. Now, something can be first in our lives, and yet because of our human inconsistency, some things we occasionally do aren't really in keeping with that priority. I mean, it may be that for example, your marriage is the first thing in your life, or your children or something. And yet, some of the things you do in a weak or selfish moment would be things that aren't really reflective of that priority, perhaps. And the same thing is true of, you know, if my whole life is devoted to God, well, that's what makes me a believer. That's what makes me a Christian. And it will show up. If my life is devoted to God, that's going to show up in the way I behave. I'm going to be concerned about what he's concerned about. I'm going to care about his priorities. If he's concerned about the poor and the disadvantaged, well, I'm going to be concerned about them too. Now, I will also at times fall short of doing perfect things because I'm not a perfect person. But my trend, my dominant desire and dominant behavior in my life is going to be focused on fulfilling the priorities that I believe are God's priorities. Not because I'm afraid. I already have my salvation. I'm not doing this to get salvation. I'm doing this because being saved involved my becoming committed to Christ in this way. If I'm committed to Christ, well, people live by their commitments. I mean, with varying degrees of consistency, obviously. We're inconsistent people. But you can tell what a person's priorities are. You live with someone, you know, for a while, you'll soon know what they value most. Because it's going to be on their mind, they'll be talking about it, they'll be investing their money in it, they'll be spending their time with it. I mean, you can tell what someone values. And if a person values the things of God most, then they're going to be interested in their finances and their time and their you know, opportunities being used to promote the ways of God. It doesn't mean that every single thing they do will be like a religious kind of a thing. It just means they'll be loving people because that's what God wants us to be. And love doesn't just mean I have fondness for someone. It means I care about their needs as much as I care about my own. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm going to go to prison every weekend and talk to the prisoners. I might be glad to do so, but that might not be, I mean, I might be very busy about God's business in some other area, so I never really have time to go to prison. I myself have been into prison several times to minister, but it's, I wouldn't say it's been any kind of a significant part of my ministry. I've done it maybe, I'd say, a dozen times in 50 years, just because that's, I'm busy about other kinds of ministry. Same thing with feeding the poor. I don't go out and look up poor people on the street to give them money, although I do have a giving policy. You know, a certain percentage of all my money I give to ministries that feed the poor. And different Christians will have different percentages of how they do that because their ability is different. I mean, some people can maybe give 10%. Some can give maybe more than that. But the thing is, God's not going to, you know, say, okay, John, you had 3 weekends when you could have gone into the prison and preached the gospel there, and instead you spent time with your family. Well, you know, that's not, God's not going to judge you that way. He's not judging you by the particular way you spent a particular afternoon, although if what you did on that afternoon was something that was very selfish and or evil, of course that's going to be noticed. But the point is, if you're seeking to serve God, generally speaking, in your life, and it's your real desire to please Him every moment, then you can relax and say, well, I'll just let God lead me, and I'll be seeking to find out what He wants me to do with my life. Some people, remember, Paul said people have different gifts, and some have the gift of showing mercy, some have the gift of leading, some have the gift of teaching, some have the gift of prophecy or something like that. Not everyone's going to be doing the same things, but all Christians will have, they will have shared concerns. And that is, if it matters to God, it matters to me. If it's His priority, then it's going to be high on my priority list. There might be a list of things that I know to be God's priorities, and one or two of them are the ones I know that God has me involved in. And, you know, three or four down the list, I may have very minimal involvement in, only because I'm just one man. And I only have one moment at a time, and I can't do, I mean, I could either do a lot of things poorly, or I can do a few things well, and that I have to decide based on what I think God's leading me to do. But it's not a nervous thing that comes with, well, what if I make the wrong decision on how I use this particular weekend? Is God going to flame, out at me and burn me to a crisp because I didn't do something I could have done better? That kind of attitude toward God is something that one, if someone has that, they need to overcome it. That's something you were conditioned with, apparently, in your upbringing, and needs to be done away with. Are there a lot of Christians who don't go to prisons, you asked, and don't do much for the poor? I think there are, but they could be true Christians if, let's just say, they're doing what they know to do and what they can do. Not everyone can do the same things. Or equally well. I think we need to ask ourselves, what is God's calling on my life? What is His gift that He's given me? How can I best use it for His service? Now, of course, everybody has some ways they can help the poor, but some people may have very little. Some people may be themselves the poor, and they may have very little that they can give to other poor. But to the degree that we know we can, we will want to, if we have the heart of God, if we're born again, and have the Spirit of God and the mind of Christ, I think we're going to be wanting to do those kinds of things. And that's what's going to show up at the judgment, is what kind of things were you doing when you're doing what you wanted to do, you know? And, maybe one person gave a lot more to the poor than you did, or maybe one person preached to more people than you did, or one person went to prisons more sacrificially and more often than you did. But that doesn't mean you didn't do what God wanted you to do. You need to be concerned not with comparing yourself with other people's activities, but just asking yourself, am I living to please God right now? Am I doing what I think God has equipped and called me to do and give me opportunity to do? And it's the answer to that question, I think, will be what at the judgment will show up. Now, your second question is, well, how come this is so if salvation is not of works? Well, salvation is not of works, But salvation is demonstrated by works. You know, we're saved by faith. But when a person comes before a court and stands before a judge, and the judge says, you know, how do you plead? If the guy says, I'm innocent, I'm not guilty, well, he may be right or wrong. But once we know what his plea is, then we want to look at the evidence. You're not going to, you know, he's not going to be, the verdict is not going to be based on what he claimed about himself. We find out what he thinks about himself when he makes his plea, and then you bring out the evidence. And if the evidence supports his plea, he's declared not guilty. Same thing with us. When you stand before God, say, yeah, I believed in Jesus. I believed in Jesus. I was committed to Jesus. God says, okay, great, wonderful. Let's pull out the evidence, and we'll try to justify your claim here. And if your behavior shows that you didn't serve Jesus and you didn't care about Jesus, well, then he's going to say, sorry, I don't think you did believe. Because faith without works is dead. If you say you believe something and it doesn't affect the way you behave, then you don't believe it in a way that we're talking about when we talk about being saved by faith. So you're not saved just by believing certain things. You're saved by having a faith and a confidence in God that is a total embracing of all that he is and all that he claims. And your behavior will show if that is you or not. And so the judgment is of works only because court cases have to be decided on the basis of evidence. The man who, you know, the evidence is in his favor isn't saved because of that. He's saved because he's innocent. If the evidence is in favor of his innocence, that's great. It just proves that he is innocent. He's saved because he's innocent. The evidence is just what shows that he's innocent. And likewise, a person who's saved, you know, in the sense of Christian faith, is saved because they believe. They're not saved because of anything else, but because they believed. And the evidence will be provided to show that he did. And that'll be his works. So that's it. I think that Christians need to be more aware that their works are under scrutiny and that God is going to call us on account for our works. But they need to be aware of that in the mental milieu of knowing that God is on our side. God is not looking for excuses to condemn us. He's looking for excuses not to. He's much more disposed to forgive than he is to condemn. Jesus didn't come into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. But he said the problem is the world was already condemned. And the world already didn't want salvation. The light came into the world and they loved the darkness instead. So, I mean, God can't save somebody if they don't want him. But if a person truly wants him, he knows it. And if a person truly surrenders to him, he's glad. And, you know, it may be that only a little bit of evidence is available. Like the thief on the cross, we don't have an awful lot of evidence of his faith except that he confessed Christ in that situation. But that's all the evidence apparently that's going to be needed, because that's all that was available for him. He couldn't do anything else. He was nailed to a cross. So anyway, those are my thoughts to what you're saying. I'm always sorry to hear of somebody who's struggling in their view of God in that way. And you know, I have a lecture series at my website called How Can I Know That I'm Really Saved? That might be helpful to you. Of course, all the lectures at my website are free. It's thenarrowpath.com. We're going to talk next to Brother Junior from Maryland. Hi, Junior. Good to hear from you.
Hey, good to hear from you, too. I hope your wife is doing well.
Yes, so getting better.
That's good. So I have a question that is specifically in Ephesians 5, verse 33, and it's a two-part question. And I will take the question on the phone because I can't find the link to hear it, so I'll just go on mute. The question is, why is it that the husband must give love as opposed to respect, and why is it that wives must give respect as opposed to love? The second question is, why is it that the Amplified Version has a longer description or text in the verse 33? And is the Amplified Version more accurate or correct in the description? And why?
Okay.
And I'll go on mute.
Okay. Well, the Amplified Version is longer because that's the Amplified Version. That's why it's called Amplified. I once knew of a Christian rock band called the Amplified New Testament because they had amplifiers, big amplifiers. But amplified means it's expanded, And the Amplified is not, strictly speaking, a normal translation. They're not looking for the best word to translate a Greek word, the best English word. They try to include all the English words that could translate a Greek word. Almost all translations, when you find a Greek word, the translator tries to say, what is the best English equivalent to this word that we can put in here? The Amplified version says, let's just put them all in. And so you've got all these additional words. In some cases, it's very burdensome to read because you don't need all those words, but they just want the reader in English to know how many ways this word can go. And so that's why the Amplified version is longer. Every verse it has in it is longer. So that explains that. But as far as why is the husband told to love his wife and the wife to revere her husband or respect her husband, as opposed to the other way around? Well, it's not either or. I mean, in Titus chapter 2, Paul said that women need to learn to love their husbands and love their children. Okay, so in Ephesians, the husband has to love his wife as Christ loves the church. In Titus 2, written by the same author, he says, you know, you older women should teach the younger women to love their husbands and love their children and so forth, be homemakers. So both are expected to love each other. And when it comes to respect, it does say at the end of Ephesians 5 that the wife should respect her husband. Actually, the word in the Greek is fear, but it's using the word not in the sense of kind of being terrorized, but in the sense of reverence, having reverence for her husband. But in 1 Peter chapter 3, Peter says that the husband must show honor unto his wife as unto the weaker vessel. So the husband has to honor his wife. The wife has to, you know, respect her husband. They're both commanded to love each other. So, I guess the reason you don't find all these ideas in all the passages is because Paul didn't have the mentality of the Amplified Bible. He didn't have to put everything he thought in one verse. But he made the points he wanted to make in that particular context. And in other contexts, he makes the points that he didn't make in this verse, but which cover the ground that you're asking about.
Thank you.
All right, brother.
God bless.
Great to hear from you. Bye now. All right, let's talk next to Mike from Carson, California. Mike, welcome to The Narrow Path.
All right. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Quick question for you, and I'll take the answer off the air. I've heard your arguments against the sons of God being literal angels and mating with women, as it talks about in Genesis 6:4. And then when they made it, they produced giants. And you mentioned in your arguments against the idea of those actually being angels, you mentioned that like spirits can't mate with flesh. But then I wanted to point out to you the angels that visited Lot in Genesis 19:1. They were in physical form, and it seemed that they were highly sought after by the people of Sodom at that time. So if you could tell me if those guys were physical beings and if
absolutely.
They could have made it.
Yeah, they came in physical form, true. Now, they looked like men, and so the men of Sodom related to them as if they were men. But we don't have any reason to believe that those angels had human DNA. You know, God appeared in a human form, too, in that same story. I mean, the story of Sodom and Gomorrah is in chapter 19 of Genesis, the previous chapter, chapter 18, verse 1. Those two angels and God appeared to Abram in the form of three men. Now, and they ate with him, so they had some biological human functions they had too. But I think it's best to understand that they weren't actual men. They were, in this case, spiritual beings, God and angels, taking on, briefly, a human form so as to meet in a way that Abram could see them and talk with them and relate to them, as it were, man to man. And therefore, my understanding would be that this is not really, they weren't real men. They are called men because they had the appearance of men. One is actually God himself. One is called Yahweh. And the other two are shown to be angels. And Yahweh and angels are not men. So we have to say they took on a human form. But how much did that human form, how far down into their nature did that go? Did they just take on a visible humanity? The gross anatomy of human beings? Or were they right down to the cellular level, down to the DNA? Were they human? If they were, that's a strange thing because human DNA has history to it. I mean, the DNA you have has to do with the combination of your parents' DNA, and theirs has to do with the combination of their parents' DNA. And so any person that has DNA, which everyone does in every cell of their body, has a DNA that shows the history of their ancestry going back. That's why you can go to 23andMe and find out who your ancestors were by they take a sample of your DNA. Now, did God appear in a human form with a DNA, which if you sent it off to 23andMe, you'd find out his ancestry went back to Adam through a certain way? I don't think so. I think they took on a human-like form, but I don't believe they were true humans, and I don't think they had human DNA. I think it was more of a human appearance. It was physical, but I think it was a human-like appearance. But I don't think they could reproduce with human women, and that because you have to have human DNA. You can't reproduce without DNA from both parents. So I don't know that angels had that capacity. My opinion is they did not. I could be wrong, because I guess no one knows for sure. And we don't really read of the giants being their children. If you read more carefully in Genesis 6, it just says the giants were in the land in those days, and even after that, when these marriages took place. It doesn't say they were from those marriages. Hey, I appreciate your call, and thank you for joining us. If you're listening to The Narrow Path, we have another half hour coming up, so don't go away. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. You can find out all kinds of stuff about us there, thenarrowpath.com. I'll be back in 30 seconds.
Small is the gate, and narrow is the path that leads to life. We're proud to welcome you to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve has nothing to sell you today, but everything to give you. When today's radio show is over, we invite you to visit thenarrowpath.com, where you'll find topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and the archives of all the radio shows. Study, learn, and enjoy. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour taking your calls. If you'd like to join us, we actually have a line or two that have opened up. If you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian life or maybe a disagreement with the host like the previous caller, you're welcome to join us here. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. 37. And our next caller is Nick from Massachusetts. Welcome to the Narrow Path, Nick.
Hi, Steve. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I actually called you last week for the first time, and I didn't get a chance to say I appreciate your ministry very much. I'm newly saved, as I told you last week, within the past 2 years, and I've been, you know, weeding through a bunch of different ministries and doctrines out there, and you know, have found a lot of them after some time to just be, I think, corrupted by Satan or something. And I stumbled upon your program about 3 months ago, and I love it. And it's sound biblical teaching, and I'm grateful for it. So that's what I wanted to say. My question for you today is regarding my church. I have been attending a home church since last October, and I just wanted to know what your opinion was about changing churches or looking for another church if you don't feel fulfilled. I feel like I owe a certain kind of loyalty to my pastor, and I don't know if I'm being, you know, running on self-will if I, you know, I want to look around and see if I can find another church to attend. But I just wanted to see what your opinion was on that.
Well, I don't think that you have to be loyal to the same church all your life, you know, even if you owe a great deal to the pastor or whatever. I do think changing churches should not be a quick decision because, frankly, if you've been going to any church for very long, hopefully you've got some relationships built there with other families and people there. And it's those relationships that are so hard to find in the modern world. The modern secular world has pretty much lost its sense of community. Which is why social media has taken over so much. People are looking for a sense of community, so they find their little group online, and then they feel like they have society, you know. But you need people, real people, not just screens. computer screens and phone screens. And so fellowship with real people is very valuable. And whenever you change churches, you're giving up, unless, of course, you're not. But in most cases, you're giving up some relationships that, you know, they may say, well, we'll still be friends with you. But in most cases, you don't see them very much anymore because they're involved in the activities of their church and you're doing something else somewhere else, which is fine. It's just not always easy to find good relationships in church. Now, a lot of people leave a church because the pastor's not preaching well. Maybe he's preaching bad stuff. Or because they don't like the, you know, something about the style of worship or something. Or maybe there's even more carnal reasons. You know, I don't like to be with people that age or whatever. But if you leave a church, I think it should be because, it is a church that is not really seeking to represent Christ and not seeking to cultivate the body of Christ. What I mean by that is lots of churches, especially some very large ones, become large not by cultivating the body of Christ, but by making their services appealing to a larger, broader spectrum of people, some of whom might not even be Christian, or if they are, sometimes they're not really interested in Christian things so much, so the church has to dumb down the sermons and water them down and avoid saying things that would offend the touchy people in the church and so forth. And you really don't have, that's not a good thing in a church, in my opinion. That's, in fact, not just my opinion. It's just not good. Not good in a church to do that. You need to have a church that cultivates the life of the Christian body there, that's trying to build up the saints, trying to disciple them, trying to teach them to observe the things of Christ that he said. I mean, that's what the church's job is. And if you find that, you know, the ministry from the pulpit there is not doing that very well, and yet you're finding good Christian people in the congregation that you're actually connecting with, and you're actually, you know, even outside church, they're in your life. You've made some good friends who you actually see socially or in their homes and things like that. I mean, if you get that kind of a thing going on, you've got something that's much more rare today than it used to be in churches. And what you need to find is relationships with people who are committed to Christ, eager to be changed and sanctified, and eager to help you to be. I mean, it's sort of just a mutual relational thing that's going to build you both up and edify you. If you find two or three friends like that in a church, you have found more than what many Christians can find anywhere now. And so if you have that, fine. Now, if you don't, if you know, you haven't really developed any relationships in the church, maybe you've even tried and it's just not happening, then it may be that God's moving you somewhere else because he really wants you to be involved with the body of Christ. It's not so much an organized church meeting that matters, although ideally you should be able to find the body of Christ in organized church meetings, and in the best of them you will. And that's why I would go looking for them. You know, if I came to a new town and I didn't know any Christians there, I'd frankly start going to churches and trying to find the body of Christ, trying to find members of the body and other disciples who have, you know, have a passion for Christ. If I couldn't find them, it'd be discouraging. Then I don't know what I'd do actually. But I guess I'd just keep looking and I'd keep trying. But I wouldn't stay in a church for very long if, A, it was not nurturing my discipleship or anyone else's, let us say. Let's just say the preacher's just there to entertain and no one's really being discipled at all. And B, I'm not really connecting with people in any way. I think one thing you really need to be looking for, too, is it a church where you can plug in, where you can, you know, serve in some way, and where there's people who have an interest in serving your needs, too. I mean, that's the point. The body of Christ is different members of the body seeking to serve each other for the glory of God. And if you have a church where that's just not what's happening there, then you probably will want to look for another church. And any sense that I have to be loyal to my pastor, well, I like loyalty. I think we should be loyal to our friends. I think we should be loyal to people who've done us favors and have shown friendship to us and so forth. We should. But being loyal to the pastor doesn't mean you have to go to his church. You can still think highly of him. If you're indebted to him, if he's a friend to you, you can. That all can continue as long as he'll let it to. Now, some pastors may say, well, if you leave here, I'm not going to be your friend. Well, then he's the one who's got the problem, not you. But, I mean, the body of Christ isn't all in one congregation. And no one has some kind of an obligation to stay in the same congregation, no matter what, whether it's helpful or not. Some churches are churches I would be able to tolerate and maybe find friends in. But let's say if I was raising kids, they're not the kind of churches I want to raise my kids in. Like the guy who called in our first half hour, he was raised in a church where, you know, people were taught that God's, you know, going to send you to hell if you do something wrong. I wouldn't want my kids raised in a church like that. Now, if I happen to find some good friends and they happen to attend a church that had that defect, I could endure it. I could survive it. I mean, I'm looking for fellowship with people who love Jesus. And if the pastor's not very good at preaching and doesn't preach good things, I can still survive that. But there'd be things I wouldn't take my kids to. So there's a lot to consider there. But if your basic question is it wrong for you to find another church? No. No, it's not wrong for you to do so. You should try to be in a fellowship where there are some of these good things happening, especially where you're being nurtured and where you have the ability to serve and nurture others too, eventually, with whatever gifts God gives you.
Awesome. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff to consider there. I appreciate that. I have a good connection with some people, but I do feel like I've kind of hit a wall in a sense, but that might be due to some issues I have with being vulnerable. But, you said a lot of good things, Steve. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, Nick. God bless you. I hope you find the right group. Bye-bye. Stay in the right group. All right. God bless. Ryan from Linwood, Washington, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. I just had a question about, I believe it was Genesis 10, where it talks about, like, the lineage, the descendants of Ham.
Mm-hmm.
And it says they have their languages. You know, each group has their own languages. And then in the Tower of Babel, it says they all have one language. I was just wondering if you could explain that.
Yeah, well, chapter 10.
I'll take it over the radio.
Okay. In chapter 10 of Genesis, we have what's usually called the Table of Nations. And it takes each of the sons of Noah, which, of course, were the only survivors of the flood besides Noah himself. And it was through his sons that his lineage continued. So all people after the flood came from one of these three sons. And first talks about the sons of Japheth. And then it talks about the sons of Ham. And then it talks about the sons of Shem. And it goes several generations down. It talks about the sons of these sons going down to their grandchildren and great-grandchildren, sometimes great-great-grandchildren, and what nations eventually came from them. And in each case, it says something like, everyone from these, the Gentiles were separated into their lands, everyone according to his own language, according to their families, into their nations. Okay. Now, that doesn't mean in the first generation that the sons of Japheth, for example, were separate nations. I mean, no, if you've got, let's say you've got 10 kids, those are not immediately 10 nations, so they might become such, just like Jacob's 12 sons became 12 tribes, each one of them big enough to be a small nation, I suppose. But the point is that this is telling, you know, several generations of what became down. Eventually, the sons of Japheth were divided into these nations and these different languages. Same thing when it goes through the sons of Ham. They were divided into different nations and different languages. Now, when you get to chapter 11, you've got the story of the Tower of Babel, and at the beginning of it says everyone had the same language. Well, that's not contradicting, because what Babel's talked about, the Tower of Babel, is, you know, maybe two or three generations after the flood, possibly. Nimrod's time was apparently two generations or three after the flood. So two or three generations after the flood, everyone was of the same language. But that doesn't contradict the fact that the sons of Japheth eventually, and the sons of Ham eventually, and the sons of Shem eventually divide into all these different nations with their separate languages. It's simply, you know, the chapter 10 starts at the time after the flood and it looks forward many generations to a time when these three sons gave rise to, you know, 70 nations with different languages and so forth. But that had to take, you know, some generations. Probably that probably it looks forward, you know, 10, 20, 30 generations. Who knows? And then Genesis 11 goes back to, again, shortly after the flood, to a time when they had one language, and it tells how the various languages came about. But it doesn't, it's not contradictory unless you're assuming that chapter 11, has to follow chronologically everything that was in chapter 10. Chapter 10 looked generations beyond the flood, and that's why it mentions languages and nations. But certainly not in the first one or two or three generations after the flood. For example, if I had 10 kids, and each of my kids had 10, and each of my kids had kids had 10, you know, we'd have 1,000 people or something like that, you know, in our clan. That's hardly enough to even be a nation. But that's three generations out. But maybe 10 more generations, there could be a nation's worth. So when we realize that this is, chapter 10 is telling us all the nations that came from these people, we have to realize it's not saying immediately after the flood, all these nations suddenly existed. It's looking way ahead. All right. Hey, I appreciate your call. Let's talk to Valerie from Sherwood, Oregon. Valerie, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Oh, yes, hi, Steve. Hello.
Hi. Good.
Hi. My questions are, what do you think of the book Jesus Calling? I think it's by Sarah Young. And also, what's your opinion of the new Bible they call The Message? I think it's fairly new.
It's not very new, but it's a relatively new translation. I try to avoid giving anything like an authoritative critique on books I have not read. Now, I've read enough of The Message to make a comment about it, but I have not ever read any of the books in the Jesus Calling series.
Okay.
And I have heard people say things about it which make me think it's not something that I would recommend. But every time I've said that much, I've got people writing me saying, no, it's a good book. You should read it before you say it's not good. So, you know, I just want to avoid, I want to avoid saying anything I don't know anything about.
I understand.
But as far as The Message is concerned, it is not the kind of Bible that I recommend. It's not a translation by any stretch.
Okay.
It's a paraphrase, sort of like the old Living Bible that came out in the 70s that was a paraphrase. But the difference is the Living Bible stuck by the text. It paraphrased, mm-hmm. but it paraphrased the text kind of closely. The Message, sometimes not a single word in one of the verses connects to any word in the original. It's rather, the translator of The Message was a Hebrew and Greek scholar. I mean, he knew the languages, but his philosophy of translation was simply not something I'd be interested in handing to somebody to read the Bible, because what he thought was, I'll read the verse, and I'll just kind of restate the ideas that I'm getting from this verse in my own language. And of course, his own idioms, his own choice of words, generally speaking, didn't connect very closely with any of the words or even the idioms in the original. He just, he kind of got a general idea of what the text meant by reading it in the Greek or Hebrew. And then he kind of restated his own general ideas about what it meant into his own words without any translating involved at all, in most cases. Now, I want to say that, I don't know the man. I know people who've known him. I know the people who've studied under him and so forth, and they thought highly of him as a Christian man and a scholar. And I'm not necessarily going to criticize the man whom I never met and don't know anything about, except that some people I know knew him and thought he was a good guy. But I can critique his work. His work is simply not a Bible. It's more like a man restating what he thinks the Bible means in his own words. And, I personally think that reading paraphrases can be helpful as long as you're not trying to study them as a Bible. You want to, when you study the Bible, get as close to the original languages as you can, because that way you'll discover what kinds of phrases and words each author uses regularly, and you'll be able to see how they're using them and what the nuances are of them and so forth. But if someone paraphrases so much you don't even know what words the original used, then you'll never become familiar with the language of the original. You just become familiar with what the paraphraser thinks you should take from the text. And I don't like other people telling me what I must take from the text. I'd rather read the text, take from it what I can get from it. I don't mind reading, peripherally, a passage from the New Living Translation or from the NIV or from the Message or something like that to see how somebody else thinks, you know, what they're seeing in it. I don't mind them telling me what they're seeing in it. Just don't tell me that what they're seeing in it is the same thing as the text itself. You know, so I would never study the Message. I would maybe on occasion, if I'm reading a passage in the Bible and it's a little obscure, I might pull out the Message and say, I wonder what this guy thought it meant. And I'd read what he said, and then I'd decide, I don't see that there. Or I do. I think, I think he may be seeing something there. You know, I mean, that's for me to judge. But if I only read him, I wouldn't be able to make the judgment. I wouldn't know what the text said. I just know what he tells me it means. And that's
so it's probably okay for someone who's read the Bible to enjoy the Message, but it's not really a Bible.
I would say reading the Message is something you might do after you read the Bible. Yeah. But I would never, even if you've read the Bible a couple times, I would never then substitute that, you know, with the Message. Say, I like the Message. I'm going to read that from now on. No, you need to study the real Bible. And
I know some pastors who just love those books, and I don't care for them. You know, I care for the pastors, but the books, and we had Jesus Calling, and we threw it away years ago.
Yeah, I have no idea. I have no idea why any pastor would recommend the Message.
My pastor says that's his favorite book next to the Bible.
Jesus Calling is? You know, I have some favorite books besides the Bible.
Yeah.
But they're not that kind of book, you know. They're not a book where some woman is saying that Jesus is, you know, she's channeling Jesus. Now, of course, she doesn't claim to be channeling Jesus, but she writes in the first person as if she is Jesus speaking.
I don't like that.
I don't need that. Thanks. I'd rather the real Jesus. How about if I just read what the real Jesus said?
Yes, and his word can stand alone. We don't need some woman channeling or whatever she's doing.
Yeah, I know.
Well, thank you, Steve. I'm glad for this information. I very much value your opinions. And I'll just kind of be grateful to these people about, you know, whatever they want to do. They're capable pastors and everything. But, you know, I just want to hear your opinion.
I want to let you in on a little secret. A lot of pastors never, ever study the Bible. There are a lot of pastors, evangelical pastors, pastoring evangelical congregations, there are a lot of them who've never read the whole Bible. And,
oh, my goodness.
What they did is they took, you know, Bible school seminary classes where they had to study Romans and the Gospel of John, and they might have had to translate 1 John, and they probably read Genesis. And, you know, they had some books of the Bible they had to study, with the understanding that they should be studying the rest of the Bible on their own for the rest of their life. But once they get hired as pastors, in many cases, they've got so many administrative duties, so many staff management headaches and things like that, that they never get around to studying the Bible. And there are services that a pastor can subscribe to, which will send him his sermons. They'll send him, you know, Sunday morning and Sunday evening sermons for a year. And I was offered these. I got them in the mail. What in the world would anyone do with these, you know? Why would I want somebody else to do my thinking and my preaching for me? But you see, many pastors are not gifted at study or teaching, and they find it a chore, or they may like it, but they simply don't have time because of all the administrative stuff pastors are required to do. And, for whatever reason, most pastors never study the Bible. So they just as soon get a good paraphrase that kind of speaks. It almost is a sermon in itself because it's,
And my pastor's favorite Bible is the NIV. That's what he teaches.
that's not high on my list. Yeah. Yeah, you know, I want to study the Bible. I think the very best thing would be to read the Greek and the Hebrew itself, but to the degree that I'm not scholarly enough to do that, I'd like to use an interlinear English, you know, Greek or English Hebrew Bible, or a very good English translation that actually, where the translators have done their very best to give us a word-for-word rendering of the original languages. But as soon as you get to Bibles like the NIV and others and the New Living Translation, that they don't make that effort. They're not trying to give you the exact words. They're trying to give you a dynamic equivalence or a thought-for-thought equivalence. And I'll do that myself, thanks. I don't need my Bible translators to think for me. I'll do my own thinking. Just tell me what
there
it says.
There we go. Yes. Well, thank you so much. Enjoyed talking to you.
Okay, good talking to you, Valerie. Thanks for your call. Gianna from Brentwood, California. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi. Hi. I have a question in Luke chapter 20, verse 41 through 47.
Okay.
I just have a hard time understanding it, and I'm wondering if when he gets the David part is what I'm not really grasping, and then at the end, if he's just kind of like, you know, giving it to the scribes because they're
questions. Yeah. Well, Jesus has been challenged in the previous verses by various religious leaders trying to trap him on something. And, you know, the Pharisees, a lawyer, the Sadducees, these different people have tried to trip him up. And once they can't get him tripped up, he turns on them and says, well, let me ask you a question. You know, who's the Messiah? Whose son is he supposed to be? Now, their theology told them he's the son of David, which is quite true. And they said, he's David's son. Then Jesus said, well, let me ask you this then. David wrote Psalm 110, right? How come David spoke about the Messiah as his Lord? If the Messiah is David's son, why did David call the Messiah his Lord? Now, of course, the Pharisees couldn't answer it. And Jesus didn't give them an answer, but we could answer it because we know the New Testament teaches that the Messiah is not only David's son, he's also the Son of God. And therefore, though he is David's son, he's not only David's son, he's also the Son of God, which is why David had to look up to him not only as his son, but as his Lord. Now, that's the right answer, and that's the answer the New Testament would give, but the Pharisees didn't know that answer. So Jesus caught them. Basically, what he's saying is, You know, your concept of the Messiah is apparently deficient because you only think of the Messiah as David's son, but no man ever spoke of his own son as his Lord, did he? You know? So what he's hinting at what he doesn't say, namely that the Messiah is not only David's son, he's also more than David's son. He's the Son of God. But Jesus doesn't sort it out for them. He leaves them holding the bag, realizing that they don't know the answer. However, until they do know the answer, they're going to have to say, we don't understand the Messiah quite properly yet, apparently, because there are scriptures that do not fit into our paradigm. So that's what he's doing there. He's simply trying to point out to them that they have not taken into consideration the entire testimony of the scriptures informing their view of the Messiah, because they just expect him to be an ordinary man who's descended from David and did the things David did: deliver the people from bondage, build up Israel as a great empire in the region, and so forth. But he says, no, he's more than that. Got to be, or else why would David call him his Lord? Hey, I need to go. I'm sorry to say that. I wish I didn't have to go. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. We are listener supported. If you'd like to write to us, our address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow.